Do design decisions involve value judgments? Andy Halliwell has gone and posted this question on LinkedIn as part of our redesigning D&T project and debates. I think this is a really tricky one to answer, and our expert group felt that it was an important question that needed debating. Do design decisions involve value judgments? I think firstly, I'd be saying, what do you mean by a value judgment, a values judgment? And maybe in your response to Andy's question, you'll explore what you understand and what your views are of what value judgments are, and then whether they actually impinge on or affect the design decisions that designers make and also that children make in D&T lessons. So do join the debate. We're always open to conversation and discussion on this. But for now, on to the next episode. This is the Talking D&T Podcast, episode 44. Welcome to the Talking D&T Podcast with me, Alison Hardy, a podcast for anybody interested in design and technology education, where I'll be sharing news, views, ideas and opinions about D&T. Okay, so today I'm talking to my good friend Matt McLean. We've had quite a long conversation before we're joining this, so we might kind of accidentally refer back to earlier parts of our conversation, so I'm going to apologise in advance. But me and Matt talk regularly about design and technology, so I'm really pleased it is coming on the podcast, and you can all have a bit of an insight into the sort of things that we talk about. So Matt, do you want to give us a little bit of blurb about you, who you are, what you do, where you are?
Yeah, sure. I've been a D&T educator for, I think, 22 years now. So first 11 years were in schools, taught in two schools in the Merseyside area. And for the last 11 years, I've been a teacher educator at Liverpool John Mears University. Started off leading the PGCE in design and technology. Spent a little bit of a while leading secondary. Now not doing that anymore. And I wanted to get more involved with researching, particularly into researching pedagogy in D&T. So I'm trying to do a lot of writing, trying to finish my PhD, blah, blah, blah. Yeah.
No, but, you know, it is good to have that space, isn't it, to get on with your research. I mean, because both you and I did our masters, didn't we, at Sheffield Hallam? Mm-hmm. I was thinking about yesterday.
Yeah.
I think, you know, I think you're a little bit younger than me, so I think you did yours, the year or so after, I think?
But I think so, yeah. I think I started the year after you, and then I had a bit of a gap in between. So I think I did mine over 4 years rather than 3 years. But yeah, no, that master's really was... I'd sort of said to myself I was never going to do studying again, and then Andy Mitchell twisted my arm to do it. It was funded. I sort of got suckered in by doing a year long postgraduate certificate into that. Then so well, why don't you do the next bit? Oh no, why don't you finish your full master's? So I sort of became a reluctant academic in many ways, and now I find myself working towards a PhD.
Well, a fully fledged academic. I see you as more of an more of an academic than I am.
I sort of talk the talk at times, I think.
Well, I think you're much better read than I am in terms of talking about, I mean, some of our conversations that we're not going to talk about today, like philosophy and technology and education, I like sit there and go, no, my brain can't cope with any more of this. Thanks, Matt. Can we just talk about something else for a little bit?
Yeah, but I don't necessarily always understand it myself. As I'm talking, I'm trying to work it out in my own head.
No, that's why I like talking with you regularly, because, yeah, we kind of have those sort of conversations, don't we, and explore ideas. Yeah, and like you, the MA, kind of that was a real click point for me. To do that.
And I think what I liked about that, the way it was done, it was academic, but there was also very practical elements. We were doing it alongside teachers who were doing the same job as us.
I still refer to the module where we had to implement change. How we brought about change in our department. But anyway, that's another whole other conversation. I'd love to do a little bit of a drop here about the book, about the Learn to Teach Design and Technology book, because you've done a chapter in that, which you've done an earlier podcast around.
Yes.
And so you're, one of your things about your research is around pedagogy and design and technology.
Yeah.
So go on.
Yeah, yeah.
Kick us off.
I mean, I've been interested in pedagogy from when I was a teacher very early on in my teaching career, because I was really fascinated with how D&T was taught, how pupils learnt it. And when I came into higher education, it sort of became something I felt I had to become more involved with. And really my first dipping my toe into researching pedagogy came from a conversation with one of my students, or it was actually several of my students. They came to me asking, where can I read about demonstration? And I had to say, well, I don't know, but I'll go and find out. And I went to try and find out, and I found there was very little written out there. So I thought, well, why not write something? Why not start to do something? It started by developing a framework that mentors could use in schools to talk to student teachers about as they were preparing them to give demonstrations. And then it grew into a much larger framework. And I did some studies with that, one of which you were part of many years ago. And then I sort of evolved from demonstration because I'm interested in teacher modelling, which demonstration and teacher modelling aren't the same thing, but they do very much relate one to the other. But from that, someone introduced me to the idea of signature pedagogies. And it was an idea put across by Lee Shulman, an American academic, and he'd, with a team, investigated professional learning and come up with this idea of signature pedagogies. And initially, I just liked the way it sounded. I liked this idea that something was signature to I'm a particular discipline, and it had a bit of just the title had it got, sparked my interest. And I started thinking, well, what are the signature pedagogies in D&T? As part of that, I've recently submitted a literature review about signature pedagogies in general, which is part of my leading towards my PhD, to try and get my head around, well, what is this framework that Shulman put together?
Can I just interrupt you there? Because you've used the word framework several times.
Yeah.
So I'm curious about what you mean by a framework around pedagogies. So go on.
Well, for me, when I talk about this framework, I talk about in signature pedagogies, there's some categories or some levels. So it's not an all inclusive. It's sort of a two dimensional sort of going in a. The main one in signature pedagogies are about structures within pedagogy. So how pedagogy is structured within the classroom, and within the curriculum. So you've got surface structures, and they're the sort of concrete things you do in the classroom, things like demonstrating, questioning, interacting, and but also things like withholding information to help children to find out for themselves. Mm-hmm. So what you might call discovery learning or direct instruction. So giving information and getting children to respond to it. So those are the sort of things that will be talked about, surface structures. You've then got deep structures under that, which are sets of assumptions about what's the best way to convey a certain body of knowledge. And within D&T, there are certain approaches. We talk about designing and making. We've talked about focused practical tasks. So you've talked about mainly making, mainly designing, design making, and exploring technology and society. So there are things like that which sit a bit deeper within the way we teach D&T, which make it different to the way English is taught, history is taught, RE is taught. And then below that, you've got implicit structures. And they're the sort of things that Shulma described as the moral dimensions, and they comprise sets of beliefs about assumptions, attitudes, values, dispositions. So that sort of has a bit of a link to the research that you're doing.
Yeah, I was just thinking that we've not talked about that before, that level about implicit assumptions. That's really interesting,
And the my interest so far has been in the surface and then getting into the deep. So one of my theses or things which I'm sort of exploring and thinking about as part of what the deep structures, and I've got a suspicion that the D&T project in its many different forms is part of that deep structure.
Yeah.
Whether it's the extended design, make, evaluate project, or whether it's the more focused. I'm interested in the years to come about exploring, well, how is that done? How are projects taught? How do pupils experience it? And how do we do the things that, how do we develop pupils' resilience and their ability to work through over a period of time on something that where they don't know the answer to a solution. And that's something that's really important. If you're reading through Shulman's work and the papers that have been written about other people applying signature pedagogies, this idea that uncertainty in learning, not knowing something, is really important to signature pedagogies. And I think one of the places to look when you're asking, well, what are the signature pedagogies in a discipline? It's where do learners, where are they likely to get anxious because they don't know what's coming up? Where's the uncertainty where they have to work things out for themselves, to either draw on things they've learned before or go away and find out new things? And to me, that's a really important thing, part of what D&T is about. And one of the things I think it's important for us as D&T teachers to do is to help children to work through problems for themselves and not to over scaffold, not to take away choices from pupils, but to scaffold sufficiently so that pupils can learn to do that for themselves. And around scaffolding as well, I came across a term called fading in relation to scaffolding. And I really like it because fading is the idea of the process of removing that scaffolding.
Yeah. And that's a bit that gets forgotten about, is that scaffolding is temporary.
Yeah. And I think where we talk about spoon feeding, it's over scaffolding and not taking the scaffolding away. Because if you take the metaphor of a building, scaffolding is not meant to stay there. It's meant to come down. It goes up incrementally and it comes down incrementally.
Yeah. And that's to me about developing design and technology capability.
And
it'd be good to talk to you sometime about where you see that sort of idea sitting in that surface deep and implicit. That almost feels like it sits in the implicit about what is design and technology capability. Yeah. What are we developing?
Pupils making those choices for themselves. And if all we have in our curriculum are our focused practical tasks masquerading as design and make, so doing a little bit of surface embellishment or decoration, not that those are necessarily bad things in their place, but if that's all we do, then we're robbing children of the opportunity to develop those dispositions, those attitudes, that self-reliance and resilience.
Yeah. I know, I think that's really interesting. You've got my head spinning all over the place, partly because I'm trying to think about, you know, you're using terminology that I see in my framework around the value of the subject. You know, resilience comes up, personal development and such.
And it'd be really good to have conversations. I mean, at some point in the future about how we dovetail together what I'm working towards. So I haven't really got to the implicit structures in signature pedagogies yet, but I feel that you are sort of well in that area, and it might be. That might be an interesting conversation in the future.
Yeah, I think that'd be really exciting. I mean, let's talk some more. I mean, because we spend hours sometimes. I love the fact that sometimes we book in an hour's conversation and 2 hours later I'm saying, I've really got to go now.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, no, it's those things that, oh, yeah, and another thing, yes.
Yeah. And I like you, that idea about signature pedagogies.
Yeah.
There is something about that term that kind of makes your heart sing in a way, doesn't it? It's
something that when you've got a lot of CPD going on inside and outside schools, which is trying to accommodate all teachers, it can be quite common. And I remember this as a teacher in the classroom, sitting in CPD and thinking, okay, that might be very interesting if you're teaching mathematics or science or English, but it doesn't really apply to me. And it gives a sort of an area for dialogue and discourse for us as D&T teachers to talk about, well, what is unique about D&T? Not only what's unique about what we offer, but what's unique about how children learn and what they do. Because signature pedagogy focuses very much on knowledge in action. And that's something that I've been thinking about a lot in my writing recently, thinking about, well, what is D&T? And I think that's why we find it ourselves in a difficult place currently on a political sense, that the discussion and dialogue around what knowledge is focusing on a very particular sort of knowledge and sort of is the more of sort of knowing something, knowing that something's the case, rather than knowing how to do something. And the knowing that in D&T is changeable. But what's really important to us is the knowing how and knowledge in action. So it's not necessarily knowing how to do a particular joint or to use a particular tool or to combine particular, but actually how to bring about ends, how to do something, how to make a product or prototype using the knowledge you have or finding knowledge out for yourself. That's where I think for me D&T really sings, is how knowledge is applied, knowledge happens in action.
Yeah, because we've talked about, haven't we, about knowledge, you know, and what the knowledge base is in D&T. So what are your thoughts about that? What is the knowledge base in D&T?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of our main contention points, I think, is around materials, because we come from, historically over the past 3 or 4 decades, we've come from materially separate disciplines together into D&T. And materials are really important. So it's really important that children are given a chance to experience materiality, using materials, understanding how materials respond. What I'm less comfortable with is this sort of separation of materials, whether it's, I mean, resistant materials, what an awful name that was. Whoever came up with that. It might be a description of materials, but it's an awful description of a discipline within D&T.
Well, and then textiles becomes compliant materials, it's just like, and you can even hear the gendered aspect of that as well. Anyway, we kind of digress. Go back to materiality.
But I think around materials, I think there's some really important concepts which on one level sound quite philosophical, but do help. I sort of contextualise. So actually, when we interact with materials, whatever the material is, largely we either add materials together, we join, we remove material, we subtract material, we can shape or deform, we can reform materials. And some of those principles I think are really important. And it is really important that we as teachers have expertise in particular materials, and it's really useful and really helpful that we have teachers in the D&T department that have different expertise, but we also need to have a broad understanding, certainly enough to teach at Key Stage 3, and particularly now as some D&T departments have had the numbers of staff working in them is much smaller, so we have to be much more multidisciplinary. But yeah, I think but For me, whilst materials are important, it's what we do with materials which I think is really important. So it's that designing, making, evaluating. I've started talking about and trying to disrupt the dialogue by using some quite complex or unfamiliar terms: ideation, realization, and critique. Critique's been a real point of interest in D&T research in the last 5 years or more. Realization takes us back. We used to have a design realization GCSE many years ago before my time teaching. And ideation has sort of come in from the design world. And I like the idea of trying to disrupt what was, for me, I find when I started, we started with a problem, then we had research, then we had analysis, then we had specification, then we had generation of ideas, then we had development
straight,
ideas.
Our straight line design process.
That linear process. And it was an unintentional consequence from trying to assess those things differently led to this this imposed linear nature in the way the D&T was taught. But the way it really works in reality for most designers is it's all together. And so you're critiquing as you're coming up, as you're ideating. But also as you're modeling ideas, you're starting to realize those. You're starting to think, well, how would this work in 3 dimensions? Or how would it work with a particular material? I think for me, it's how we go through the process of responding to a design problem, context, opportunity, to coming up with a prototype that meets a need, and that's a wiggly journey in between.
And circular in places, yeah.
And that, I think what's been really helpful in recent years is this talk about iteration, which helps us to get away from this idea that you have to have this many initial ideas, then you need to refine it down to this number of alternative ideas, and then you've got your chosen idea, which is what when I started teaching was sort of the expectation you'd have to do that. So I think it's really unhelpful for designing to put a number on things. But we all like numbers. We all like to know when we've done enough.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, we do. 10 sit-ups. Five K run. Yeah.
And I think this is one of the reasons why in our attempt as teachers to try and support children, sometimes we structure things to get the best results for them. So they get the best GCS for them because they tick all the boxes, they meet all the requirements to get the highest marks they can. But there's a real opportunity for developing their resilience, supporting their resilience by helping them to work out for themselves. And that's been something that's been a force in us by the assessment regimes, and that it is much, much better than it was 20 years ago. But I think there's still, in my opinion, a bit of a way to go, and I think there's a bit of a sort of national work to do to try and investigate different ways of doing projects over an extended period of time.
Yes.
So that's going beyond my current interest now in signature pedagogies into sort of where I'm thinking, or where my thinking is going.
But it is sort of taking what you're doing, isn't it? It is taking that idea of signature pedagogies. And as you say, you've moved beyond the surface. Remember, you know, quite a few years ago, I was doing all the work around demonstrations. And I use that with our student teachers when we talk about different ways of thinking about demonstrations. What were the ones that just in time, after? Yes.
Front loading. In time.
After failure, wasn't it? So that's... That's really useful to have that sort of dialogue around those surface pedagogies. But then you have to think about how do all of those surface pedagogies hang together or link together, or where do they come in and out of those deeper pedagogies?
Why wouldn't you use demonstration if you want children to be creative? So demonstration is very good for replicating a particular process or a particular technique, but it's a relatively restrictive approach to learning. So it's, you're demonstrating something, you're getting children then to replicate that, whereas if you want children to be coming up with their own ideas, being creative, being innovative, then a demonstration might not be the best choice.
No, but on the other hand, is teacher modeling one way of demonstrating creativity. You're modelling, and I was, I suppose, I forgot what the name is. I know Greg Strimmel's done some work on this, around Think Aloud, isn't it? You know, Think Aloud protocols is a research method. But you could imagine if you were modelling as a teacher creativity, you would think aloud what you were doing in that moment, to show.
And I think for me, whilst I would say demonstration is a subset of teacher modelling, you absolutely could use teacher modelling to model how you would solve a problem, and that would be a very appropriate. You've also got to be conscious that children will read more into what you do, so the solutions you come up with, they'll say, oh, that's what Miss likes. That's what Sarah likes, and they'll try and replicate that. So that's the thinking out loud protocol, which starts to get you thinking, well, what are different ways of doing it?
Yeah,
rather than just one way of doing it. And that's where modelling could be really useful.
Yeah. So, but just this very conversation that we're having, the dialogue that we're having about pedagogy, is really making me think about that if I was back in the classroom and I was planning to do a teacher modelling of a way of being creative, you know, like some of the stuff that Goldsmith used to do around handling collections, how I would use different handling collections to inspire me, to help me think in different ways, I would actually have to plan some of the things that I was going to say so that I didn't mislead the children, as you're saying, into thinking, oh, that's what Miss wants me to do.
Yeah, yeah. And I always think with that of Bill Nichols' paper on, he always has really great titles. I can't remember the exact title, but it was basically, if I wanted children to design a table, I wouldn't show them a table.
Yeah.
Because automatically you're restricting by this is what conceptually a table is, which stops them from thinking beyond or thinking outside the box to
draw on. The other one that I use of Bill's is No More Love Hearts.
Great titles. And you see that with in Merseyside, we see a lot of Everton or Liverpool badges. I taught in St Helens, so we saw a lot of St Helens rugby logos and stuff. And it's how do you, and again Bill talks about fixation, so how do you do that? And I think this dialogue around signature pedagogies, I think it's really important that so that we as teachers or you listening as teachers can have this dialogue around making intelligent and knowing or knowledgeable choices, understanding the benefits and limitations. So every choice you make will have both benefits and limitations, and knowing what those are and accepting them. And if there are limitations, well, how can you minimize those either at the time or at a later date? And you can minimize them by having a really broad and balanced curriculum across your key stages in D&T, where children have lots of different experiences, where you restrict and expand their experiences in a strategic way.
And also just being very upfront with children in a single lesson, isn't it? And saying, you're going to see me do lots of things in this demonstration or as I'm showing you this, but this is the bit that I want you to focus on.
And there was times when I was teaching, I would deliberately show an example which was a bit ho-hum. And I'd say to them, look, this isn't a particularly good idea. You can come up with much better ideas than I can. Because I became very conscious that I'd see student teachers, but also experienced teachers, come in and show pupils their fantastic work, which is so far above what they can achieve, that they some of them are going to be so paralyzed, thinking, well, I can't do that, and others are just going to copy what they've done. So showing sometimes our creativity can restrict pupils' creativity. So it's things like that, being really critical about our own choices.
And
thinking, well, what's the impact of that? And thinking, well, what Yes. Yeah. Taking a bit of a step back and thinking about what we're doing.
And then that nicely links onto that third layer about the implicit, doesn't it?
Mm. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And that quite often gets forgotten in a big dialogue because we're not teaching children to be design and technologists. We're teaching children to take part in society. They're already taking part in society, but we're teaching them when they're going out for themselves and looking after themselves. And most of them are not going to become designers, engineers, technologists. They're going to go into all sorts of things. So why are we teaching them what we're teaching them? Was beyond that.
Which is where it links with what I'm always interested in about, you know, what do you value about the subject? And because that does manifest itself, I think, very powerfully in what happens in the classroom.
Yeah.
You know, whether you as the teacher or the child receiving the subject, and all of that impacts. Yeah, so I think there's definitely something there, Matt, that we need to obviously have another conversation about another day about how our work is going to come together. Right. Well, I think if anybody's listening, if they're in the same state as me, I think that's as much as I can take today. But I think there's loads more that we need to come back and talk about. And we've kind of just sort of touched on the surface. Did you get that one? But I think, it'd be good to come back and have a conversation more about those three layers. And then maybe another one at some other point about the very specifics around demonstrations and teacher modelling and what's going to happen next. So, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you for inviting me. It's always a pleasure. And I learned so much from having these conversations. Even this conversation that we've had, that we've recorded for this podcast, is really helping me to get my thinking together.
Yeah, well, and I also think likewise that you've given a framework there that people listening could use And it'd be good to put some stuff in the show notes to some of the key things that people can go and pick up and start some of those conversations. Okay. Thanks very much, Matt. That was great. You've been listening to the Talking D&T podcast with me, Alison Hardy. You can connect with me on Twitter at Hardy_Alison. Show notes and transcripts for each podcast episode can be found on my website, alisonhardy.work. Thanks for listening.